this is Austin welcoming you to LL Research Radio program In the Now Q&A with Carla and crew. Today is Tuesday, January 6, 2015. Happy New Year. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. The crew in the title refers to those of us at the LL Center, beginning with Jim McCarty, Carla's husband, scribe for the Raw Contact, and president of LL Research. Gary and I, devoted seekers of the Law of One, manage LL from the home office. LL Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to freely sharing spiritually oriented information and fostering community. Towards this end has two websites. The archive website, llresearch.org, and the community website, bringforth.org. Together they offer over 1,300 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. We will be discussing questions that come from you. If you would like to ask us a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. If interested in submitting a question when we're not on the air, please visit our show's webpage at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Austin, and we're talking with Carla L. Ruckert and the home crew of LL Research. Is everybody with us and ready to go?
We're here.
We are.
Present indeed.
Alrighty, let's go straight to the opening riff, which comes from a Quo session from January 10th, 2009. Quo says, "We would encourage those who seek to become ever more full of light and more transparent to the will of the Infinite One to examine with love and not with judgment those moments of temptation, those time of listening to the insidious voice that would distract you and use up the energy of the day in doing those things which, upon thought, you may not prefer to do. As you stand closer to the light, you see every blemish, every chink in the armor of light that lies within yourself. And that, too, is a great temptation. It is a temptation to move away from spontaneity and being present in the moment, to turn to self-judgment and self-recrimination because you see these self-perceived imperfections. And yet, this too is the shadow side of self, that insidious voice that takes you away from the straight path of being transparent to the light and open to the moment, so that you may cooperate with whatever is occurring, whether it would seem to be a positive experience or a negative one."
Thank you, Austin. How easy it is to make complications for the self, to analyze and overanalyze, to examine and reexamine. Of course, we want to give everything that we have to this process, knowing the self, accepting the self, becoming the creator. We want to be earnest, and so we look perhaps overly hard at our thoughts. How can we look too closely when the Raw group suggested that that's exactly what we do? Look and look again and examine and contemplate. And within reason, this is a good process. But if you don't watch it, instead of your being in control of the process, you become ridden by the process, and you look perhaps overly closely, too hard an examining eye. It's important to maintain a lightness, a delicacy when doing this work towards yourself and towards those thought processes that are going on within the self. A little can become a lot, and a lot can become overwhelming, and all of a sudden, you really don't know where you are to work with yourself. And I think Spirit would ask in times like this that you just let it all go. Release it. Forgive it. Of course, if we look, we're going to find everything. Every down and dirty concept that is within the concept of man is going to come up in us sometime. We are all that there is. We're going to find these things within ourselves, and we can't waste time condemning ourselves, belittling ourselves, taking ourselves too seriously. Try to think of this as if you were something that had a gem within it. You know, in archaeology, when something is found in digging, it isn't dug up. It is ever so carefully brushed, and little by little, that which is underneath the soil is freed from the soil. It's that way with the gems of understanding within ourselves that we're looking for. In the first place, it's a good idea not to look at everything that you think. Have a direction to what you're looking at. You are, after all, trying to find your buried treasure. Nothing bothers you. Take a look at it. What bothered you about that? Brush it away. Brush away all the soil from it, and without disturbing its natural shape, unearth it. What is that? Is that simply more junk? The junk of an incarnation? Or have we found something good? Keep that focus as you ask yourself questions. Remember what you're looking for. You're looking for a specific kind of pain that was buried long ago and that has been triggered by something that's occurred on the surface of things. So if you get too far afield and it's not making any sense, start over. Take a new look. Brush the soil away again and see what you see. The second thing you need to remember is patience. This is work that lasts a lifetime. You will have your epiphanies. You will have your moments of aha. But they won't happen frequently, and they won't happen easily. So just be patient with yourself. Unfortunately, we sort through a lot of dirt in order to get to the gem that's hidden below. Just keep digging away. Don't worry if you find anything. And then, when you've come to something that bears spin and look, what was that? What is this? See if you can remember something in the past that triggered that feeling. What caused this kind of pain before? What caused you to feel rejected? What caused you to feel humiliated? Whatever it is that you're feeling, there are certain areas in your past that bear more likelihood of producing than others. Just keep at it. Thirdly, keep a sense of humor about it all. Yourself so seriously that you begin to think there's nothing good about you. That everywhere you look, you're going to find error. You know that's not true. Maybe you haven't gotten enough feedback from your past to give yourself confidence about this. Let your simple, the heart of things, that's your essence, the creator. Then there is something good under there. There has to be. There can't not be. Let that give you confidence. And if nothing else, if things are not working out, if your meditation is not bringing you any good, but just more confusion, let it all go and rest. You don't have to work every moment that you're meditating. You can just hang out. Have you ever hung out with the silence? Just listened. Wherever you are, there's a residual sound, the sound of your house or the sound of nature. Wherever you are, there's that half familiar, half unknown sound of things happening around you. Just rest in that. Enjoy it. Go anywhere. It doesn't have to mean anything. The silence will give you its own meaning. And what a blessed thing it is to rest in that silence. Not pushing it around, not asking it, what does this mean, what does that mean? Letting yourself be. When solutions come to you, and they come simply, they're not the end of some convoluted thought process. Let that happen. Let it come to you to a certain extent. And enjoy yourself. If you're not having fun, do something you enjoy doing. And then when you're feeling pretty good, you can do some work. Don't work on a worry, and then relax. Listen. Seek, and you will find. That's the cliche, and it's so true. But establish the seeking, and then relax around it. Don't worry it. You've got plenty of time. Find yourself. I join you in that process with joy.
Amen. Thank you very much, Carla. I think that's some advice that every spiritual seeker can use every once in a while. Before we go to questions that were sent in, we have a friend calling in, JP. And JP, you are now on the air. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Happy New Year's to everybody.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, JP. What can we do for you?
I missed all you guys. I'm glad you're back.
We are too.
Yeah, things are back to normal.
I've been reading
about the holidays, isn't there? They're lovely, but when they're over, you sort of breathe a sigh of relief.
Mm-hmm. I've been reading the PDF Wanderer's Guide book. Find it quite helpful and useful because I've always felt as an outsider. But I got a couple of questions that I haven't been able to find. Has anybody ever told Carla, or have you guys ever thought about it? But this space we occupy is so vast, it's beyond our understanding. And just our local galaxy, and then the cluster, and then the supercluster, and on and on and on. I was wondering, has anybody ever thought about how did we ever even hear about this beautiful learning school? And how did we earn passage? And did somebody escort us here, or did we stumble upon it, or how could we have possibly found this place? It's so marvelous as a school that it just boggles my mind that I've had the fortune to end up here in this time. So I'm just curious about how did all of that possibly happen? It seems so unlikely at the vastness of space. I'm about out of airtime, so I'll take my answer off the air, but I'm glad you're back, and this has been perplexing me how I can be so fortunate, because there's just so much space out there. How in the heck did I end up here? Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, JP.
Anybody want to take that one, or shall I respond?
Go ahead. Start us off.
Okay. We didn't come here out of nothing. This isn't, you know, something that happened from nothing. There's a long process precedes this experience of being in body, seeking with the people that we are seeking with, looking at what we're looking at. It didn't just happen. There is always a focus. The people that we're with are what we're looking at is what we're supposed to be looking at. We can feel fairly confident about that. So we need to simply accept that however it happened, and for whatever reasons we do not yet know, we are here, we are looking and seeking with this group of people to help us, and with unseen friends beside us in the seeking. That way, we're not overwhelmed with the hugeness of the universe. Yes, it is immense. In fact, it is immeasurable. We are part of that dance. And we're not supposed to solve it all at once. We're supposed to enjoy the process, have fun with it. Use the people that we're with, and above all, remember the unseen friends that are waiting for us to ask them for the help that they're ready to give. Spirit is always with us. Our higher self is closer than breathing. And they are vulnerable to being asked questions. No, they can't talk precisely. There's all of nature for them to use to give you signs and inklings and hints and clues. So enjoy the process. Trust that you're where you're supposed to be, looking at what you're supposed to look at, and enjoy yourself. Guys, have at it.
Firstly, JP, I really like your attitude, very positive and appreciative attitude of regarding the beauty of this place. And I presume you're identifying wanderers specifically when you say, how did we get here? But I guess actually it would apply to any demographic. But in looking at the wanderer situation, asking how did wanderers know about this place, how did they get here to serve, to me that's similar somewhat to asking how does the Peace Corps, in this country at least, know about Sudan or Armenia or Bangladesh, and how do they get people to those countries? I think this is a well-administrated universe where either by the soul's own volition or by those higher up, light and love go where it's needed, individual souls go where they're needed, and presumably in the case of wanderers, most of us are somewhat local to planet Earth, having some proximity to this galaxy or this sector of the infinite universe, though I'm sure wanderers can also wander from very far away. That's my response.
On that same point, there is a part in the raw material where Ra talks about the calling coming from Earth and how immense it is thanks to the doubling effect. I think, I can't remember their exact words, but I think it, that they say it stretches to the edges of creation or approaches infinity, one of those two things. So apparently Earth has produced a call for help, this calling of sorrow that has reached all corners of creation. The only other thought I really have to add to that is it kind of makes me wonder, in this immense universe, how many other people or beings are out there on maybe another planet on the other side of the universe just looking out at everything and thinking, how did I end up here? How? Why am I so lucky to have ended up on this planet? And it's probably something that it's a general attitude about creation that a lot of people or beings might have in their general vicinity wherever they are in the universe. Just thinking about the type of life and the type of experience that this universe can offer, the variety, the infinity of options that there are for people and things to experience in this universe. Earth is 100% unique and beautiful, but I'm sure that there are just as unique and just as beautiful places all over creation. Jim, did you have any thoughts to offer to JP?
I agree with everything that's been said. I have a hunch that since, you know, all is one, that our higher selves of both wanderers and people who have yet to make the third density to fourth density graduation know where the proper places are for being of service and for learning, and probably groups of entities go together, not just planetary or racial, but I think there are groupings of souls that have been together for a long time and continue to be together, and they are aware of where certain opportunities are. And I think that for Earth, we do attract a large population, but then I don't think people always stay right here. I think we have opportunities to go elsewhere in between incarnations, even though this might be, say, our home school, or like the home room in a school. But I think our higher selves are probably in charge of most of the placement, because they are very carefully aware of the necessary requirements for learning, for serving, and where we can find those situations.
All right. Anybody else have anything to offer to JP?
Not for me. Just a happy new year again to you, JP.
I would just say trust. Trust that you're in the right place and with the right people. And relax back into it.
Thank you so much for your call and your question, JP. It's always great to hear from you. We can go on to our questions, which were sent in now. First one comes from our friend Terry H. via email, who
has... Hey, Terry, by the way.
Hello, Terry. He has a two-part question, and they are both based on different Kuo quotes. So I'll read the first quote and then the first question, then we'll do the second one after we discuss that. So the first quote, and both of these come from September 22nd, 2007. Kuo said, "Yet accepting the self goes beyond describing oneself as a wretch, as does the old hymn Amazing Grace. It is almost, in this song, as if grace were the lone ranger that comes riding into town and saves the wretch from whatever peccadillos or villains the western desert has brought forth to threaten or to condemn. There is, in accepting the self, the necessity to move beyond the need for others' acceptance of you, and, likewise, to move beyond the need to beg acceptance of a higher power. For if one depends forever upon a higher power to be acceptable or to achieve acceptance or goodness as a spirit, then one can never become the creator, but shall always remain a beggar at the Lord's table. And many are content to be, so to be. Yet the intent of the instruction to accept the self has to do with allowing the redemptive power, such as a figure as Jesus the Christ, to become internalized. It is to acknowledge the oneness between the imperfect self and the perfected self. It is to accept the power of one's ability to judge. It is to accept one's essence as magical and creative." And so Terry asks, a sentence clicked my button. "One can never become the creator, but shall always remain a beggar at the Lord's table." From that statement, I logically assume that not being a beggar means one has equal or a bit less power as the Lord. Is this right?
I'll take the first go at that. I'm not so sure that the converse of that statement translates to Terry's conclusion. In the context of that quote, I interpret the word beggar to mean someone who's seeking their meaning or sustenance or satisfaction from outside of themselves, someone who's looking to others for approval or worth or anything to validate their own identity. Not being a beggar would mean to find your own worth and your own identity that is not dependent on others and not dependent on outside circumstance. No matter what happens, no matter what anyone says or does, you know who you are. And instead of worrying about getting and receiving from others, you can focus on radiating and giving, as Ra says, without expectation of return.
Excellent. Jim or Carla, do you guys have any thoughts?
Well, I had one, but it's been blasted away by the goodness of Gary's analysis there.
Yeah, that was quite apt. I can share my short answer. Hopefully, maybe yours will pop back into your head. And it's basically similar to what Gary was saying, but I do think that Terry's assumption is kind of logical and a bit perceptive, but I don't think that there's necessarily a distinct boundary between the movement of beggar in this context and becoming the creator. I don't think that it's just you switch from one to the other. Rather, becoming the creator, I think, is more of a path. And as Kuo continues to describe in the quote after that sentence, when one works with a higher power, there's always the potential to gradually internalize the reverence that you feel towards something that you at first believe is outside of you, as some people do. And I think that's essentially what Kuo is saying, is being a beggar here is to basically give away your reverence to something that is external to you, or at least appears to you to be external, such as Jesus the Christ as an external figure instead of something that is inside of you that you can integrate as you and become part of yourself. And so this can happen in a moment, but ultimately I think it's a path that we go through to gradually internalize this sort of reverence we have for that which is outside of us, and then begin to truly revere ourselves as the creator with just as much divinity and just as much perfection as the apparent outer higher being. And just from my experience and observation, this can happen in a single moment, but in the long run, it kind of happens gradually over time to where you don't just stop looking to the higher power and all of a sudden you have the power of the creator. It's sort of you just realize that the path is yours to walk, and then you begin to walk it consciously.
Yeah, I agree. The seeking within is really the important thing. It is important to seek and to be nourished by those who can give us more information than we have, but then eventually, you know, the process of evolution brings us to the point where we realize that we are that source, we are that authority, the creator as well. So yeah, I think it's a natural process we go through.
It did come back to me what it was I wanted to say, and that was simply that the power of poetry can move us tremendously, but we have to remember that the power that it holds is, for the most part, not literal. It holds truth, but it's not, in other words, we're not wretches. We're just other than the creator in our own perception right now. And where we would like to get is relaxing into a creatorship of our own. Not the creator of everything that there is, but the creator of our own universe of thought. So much that we can't control. But that doesn't mean that we're wretches because we can't control it. We are in error. And, you know, gradually we find those errors and we work with that, you know, over a period of time, as everybody has said. And I think we don't need to be swayed over much by a word like wretch. It's so evocative and so, you know, you just you get into it and you go, oh, I'm such a wretch. It just so takes up your whole imagination. And yet that's not the whole of who we are. We are on a quest, on a wonderful quest. And to relax into that quest rather than, you know, trotting back to where we were wretches and going, okay, how do we stop being wretches? Well, we don't, you know, we just live and laugh and live some more and cry a little. And, you know, we go through the processes of living, and they will give us what it is we need to think about. And, you know, we need to focus on what's happening to us and how we can muse upon that which is happening to us, to become more and more familiar with ourselves, to get to know ourselves. Those are my thoughts.
All right. For the next part of Terry's question, he has another quote from the same session, where Kuo says, "The end result of these two processes together is to become the creator, compassionate, loving, and understanding. This is gained by working upon the self, and once one has forgiven and become compassionate towards the self, then that entity becomes that magical person who is able to love, forgive, and have compassion on others." And so Terry asks, now in quote two, "The conclusion is that when one is able to love, forgive, and have compassion on others, then one becomes the creator. It's kind of tricky, in my honest opinion. Say, all is one, thus everyone is creator, right? So it seems to me, regardless of one's doing or non-doing, one is already the creator. In light of Christmas, may I ask, what exactly is to become the creator? Is it purely a metaphysical process, or is it a manifestation that most can witness by their physical senses?"
Well, clearly, kneeling in the rough straw of Jesus' stall in Bethlehem. It's not a literal process. And we are not literally in that situation. We are metaphorically, metaphysically in that situation. So we can look into the metaphysics of it rather than trying to look literally at who is the creator, who is not the creator, etc. We're not going to feel like the creator. Where is it written? We're just not. We're going to feel like ourselves in one shape or another. So we need to pull back from going wholeheartedly too much into literal translations of what is metaphysical stuff.
Gary, did you have any answer for this one?
Oh, I do. I think that the becoming the creator aspect in Ra's discipline of the personality is the most mysterious component of their expression, and I think that mystery is best answered by the presence of one who has become, you might say, the creator. Such an entity's vibratory signature is a greater answer to this question than any arrangement of words, though I think certain formulation of thought can point us in the direction of the unknown. I would say that becoming the creator is, as Austin and Jim were describing in the response to the previous question, a path that's lived and walked through the illusion of time. I don't know that it's a black and a white thing, that suddenly you're not the creator and then suddenly you become it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, like you said, Terry, you used the word already. I think that's key because we're already the creator and it's only perception that separates us from, that seems to separate us from that reality. So I made a list of some of the characteristics or qualities that come to my mind when I envision the third density entity who has or is becoming the creator. She is present. While her analytical faculties are still used to plan for the future or assess the past, her attention and consciousness are rooted in the eternal now. She is not looking to the future for satisfaction and fulfillment. In her presence, she is all-sufficient and not looking to anything outside of herself for her identity. As absolute consciousness, or rather, as one who has discovered absolute consciousness, she knows her identity can neither be enhanced or diminished by any event within manifestation. She perceives the oneness of all life, that is to say, she does not see anything as separate from her, whether another person or a pencil or a tree or a star, a discarnate entity or even an attacker. She is not judgmental, not blinded by separation, but imbued with love and sees only the creator. She has relinquished attachment to the individual identity. Indeed, she has recognized the illusion of the individual personhood. She recognizes each moment as an opportunity for service, first and foremost through radiance of being, and she radiates effortlessly. She doesn't cause radiation. She doesn't do anything in particular. It's just her energetic signature. She is an instrument for a will greater than the personal individual will, and even though she will invariably, by our standards, misstep and err and goof up, there's a grace and a strength to everything she does. And she knows herself as eternal and infinite consciousness and is thus in a position to know the true nature of all relative phenomena, including the processes of birth and death and time and space. And finally, she is one who Ra describes in 95.24. Ra says, "The seeker which has purely chosen the service to others' path shall certainly not have a variant apparent incarnational experience. There's no outward shelter in your illusion from the gust, flurries, and blizzards of quick and cruel catalyst. However, to the pure, all that is encountered speaks of the love and the light of the one infinite creator. the cruelest blow is seen with an ambiance of challenges offered and opportunities to come. Thusly, the great pitch of light is held high above such N1 so that all interpretation may be seen to be protected by light. And as my conception of becoming the creator is that it is a process of degrees and gradations, and it's not this plateau or this perfect state, but those are some of the more idealized qualities that I think are exhibited by one who has discovered who they really are. That's it for me.
Yeah, that's good.
I really enjoyed that, Gary. Thank you.
I think people are always the creator. We are on the path of learning, and we're always seeking the creator. And eventually we have more and more success. I think I've read of saints saying that something similar to scales would fall from their eyes as they realized more of the nature, true nature of their being. And we know that we've gone through a veil to get here into the third density so that we can operate without knowing exactly we are the creator, and that that offers us an opportunity to learn and carry more weight in our total beingness, because we basically learned it all over again. We might have a little clue deep in our being that we are one, but then we are operating without real good access to that clue. A little, maybe a distant star guiding us. So we learn again, and it seems to bring it much more forcefully to our consciousness when we learn it again.
Mm-hmm.
Those were all excellent answers. Now I'm afraid to say anything.
That's funny.
The one point, or main point, I think, that I would like to address is just the semantics when Kuo, or really anybody, any mystical speaker, says something about becoming the creator. I think that it is a bit of a more of a play upon words, but really just highlighting the fact that it's an illusion that we are not the creator already. And becoming the creator could also just mean breaking through that illusion and realizing the potential that's already there. And Kuo talks about forgiveness and compassion and being able to love another. I think that those things go hand in hand with realizing this potential. It's not that when you are not loving or forgiving or having compassion that you are not the creator, but it's that these things ultimately, at least for those upon the service to others path, are what bring the realization of this potential. We aren't ever not the creator, but through loving and through forgiveness and through compassion, we understand our true nature as a creator. We feel it, and I think in the metaphysical sense, it's a great thing, but when Terry asks about the physical senses, I don't think that necessarily from a first-person perspective, it's something that all of a sudden you see the world in different colors or something, but I do think that it is perceivable when you truly realize this, when you look at something and you realize that other something is really not other than you, that is you. You come from the same essence, the same I'm losing the word that I want to use here, but basically your form and the form of the other come from the same essential spirit, the same creator. And I think that that is perceivable in our first-person perspective, but it's not like the world all of a sudden changes and everything is rainbows. But I think that all of you had some very excellent answers to that question. Does anybody else have any more thoughts to offer?
Nope.
All righty. Thank you, Terry, for those excellent questions and the excellent quotes. Our next question comes from Kayshawn via Bringforth. I hope that we pronounced your name right. And Kayshawn asks, I am under the impression that through sleeping and meditation we experience time-space. I would like to know if you have any insight on this subject.
Okay, I'll start. Time-space. The basis for that, given I have a logical mind and I'm grateful for bases in that can be grasped and held, and velocity in the basic physical equation of the Dewey-Larson system of physics is velocity equals either space over time or time over space. Now, space over time is what we live in, space-time. What is time-space? Well, in time-space, we know that things are different. We know, for instance, that instead of time being this happens, then that happens, first yesterday, then today, then tomorrow, time is simultaneous. That's been given to us. So what is simultaneous time? Well, it suggests the model of something that's round rather than on a line, two-dimensional, one, two, three, four. It's all of those things and everything else held simultaneously as true. In other words, there is no today. It's all now. In terms of time-space, we are living in the last ultimate moment before the end of the creation. All is available. All is one. So, well, what does that feel like? Well, if you're in simultaneous time-space, then you travel not in space, but in time, and choose where you want to pop out in terms of, you know, translating from time-space to space-time. That would be amazing, wouldn't it? Time travel, it just, I mean, it boggles the mind. But the basis for it is simple. Time, space, I can think about because the Ra Group has given us a very solid model of it. And, yes, we access a place where, you know, time loosens up. When we're sleeping, God knows where we're going to dream, but it may be the present, it may be some created future in our minds, or it could be some place in our past, or in the past of the universe, or in the past of our planet, you know, history as we know it. You know, dreams can take us anywhere. So it loosens, you know, time. Being in time-space loosens all of those demands that space-time puts on us, you know, that we're stuck. We're not stuck anymore in time-space. And the same kind of thing happens with what we know. Apparently, in time-space, things are known to us that are not known in space-time. How wonderful that would be to be able to know, you know, the basis of what we're really thinking and what other people are thinking. It would be wonderful to know things like that. It would make communication so much easier. So it's not that it's an ideal place, a place that we'd, you know, rather be than here. It's that it would be other than being here. And in many ways, you know, an improvement over being here in terms of the comfort value of it, because we don't have all of these things behind the veil, you know, what's known, what's not known. We don't have that limitation. So those are some things I think about when I think of time space. Guys, go ahead.
I do think that Kayshawn is right somewhat in saying that in sleeping and meditation we get a small, at least taste of time-space. I don't think that you're experiencing time-space in the full, as
right.
In like a higher density being might experience it, or as we experience it when we're not within incarnation. But I do think that there is an aspect of time-space during sleep and during meditation and during certain parts of the day, such as when we're absorbed in something that we're passionate about, Many people will say in the zone or in the moment or something like that. And I think that the great evidence that we're experiencing an aspect of time-space here is just the distortion of our perception of time during these things. You can sleep for hours and feel as only just a few moments have passed, or sleep for just 8 minutes and feel like a full 8 hours have passed. And similarly in meditation, at least in my experience, my perception of time tends to kind of melt completely until it's not necessarily a binding thing. The present moment offers a sort of freedom in meditation from the perceived passage of time, where the just concept of time is kind of incomprehensible and doesn't hold any sway within that moment. So I do think that through meditation, that kind of experience is also a small taste of time-space, like you were saying, Carla, time-space where everything is kind of simultaneous and everything exists just as now. That taste of now, I think, can be gotten from meditation. And then, like I said, in our daily lives, when doing things that excite us, we can easily lose track of time in a similar way. Like people say, time flies when you're having fun.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is sort of also an experience of time-space because it becomes an effortless thing. You're no longer working to basically have this experience or manifest this experience in space-time. It's just sort of flowing through you, and it's just kind of happening. And I think in typical space-time, at least in our third-density space-time, we normally have to work hard to manifest things. We have to work hard to conjure an experience. We sacrifice our time, our energy, and our resources in order to accomplish any kind of goal. But from my understanding, it's not really the case in time-space. In time-space, things can just manifest with little or no effort and really no sacrifice. And so when we, even if we are in the zone, obviously we're still sacrificing time and energy in space-time, but we don't really perceive that. It's almost as if it's just happening for us. Like if we're really creating something that is close to our spirit, close to our heart, it just kind of happens without us really trying to push for it to happen. And I think that is also an aspect of time-space that we experience here in space-time. Gary or Jim, what do you guys think?
I'm grateful I am not responding to Seeker's questions by myself because I had very little to offer this particular question and definitely nothing to add to your and Carla's excellent responses, except just to point to 86.7 and 86.12 as two instances in the Law of One where Ra mentioned links the concepts of dreaming with unconscious and time, the unconscious mind and time-space. But that's all for me.
I think that both qualities, meditation and sleep, connect us to time-space, which gives us a revitalization of energies from where, you know, closer to, shall we say, to the center of creation. I don't think there's really any great way or easy way or accurate way of measuring how much time actually goes by while we're in that state. I know that Carla occasionally, as I'm sitting there next to her, or maybe watching television, or I'm reading to her, she might go to sleep for 30 seconds and wake up and tell me a very long and involved dream, which suggests that there is a whole lot more experience you can cram into what we would call a subjective amount of time, space. In meditation, I don't think there's any really good way of doing that like there is just with that little rough analogy there. But I think that we get a lot of revitalization by making contact with those, with time-space, whether it's by meditation or by dreaming and sleeping. And that's kind of like a battery recharge, a way of the intelligent energy of the Creator having access into our port, sort of like a recharging station at the airport.
Excellent. Great answers. We are pretty much out of time, so Carla,
amazing.
Would you like to say anything for our listeners?
I would certainly love to tell everybody that we love them dearly, every single one of you. And we want to answer your questions. If there's anything that you're pondering, help us ponder it with you and let us in on that process. It would be such a joy for us to do that. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you especially to those people who asked the questions today. It's just on my heart to thank you for that, because it's been really wonderful to share this thought with you today. God bless you.
And a Happy New Year to everybody as well.
Indeed.
You've been listening to LL Research's In the Now Q&A with Carla and crew. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our websites at llresearch.org and bringforth.org. And a special thank you to those of you who submitted questions. If you'd like to submit a question for us before the next show, please visit our webpage for instructions at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. Have a wonderful week, and we'll be here next Wednesday, January 14th, and we will talk with you then.
Planets turn and the old stars die and the